Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
I actually met my wife on CatholicSingles.com, if you can believe that.
Really?
Yes, I had never done that before. Didn't have any problems with dating.
Natalie and Aaron met on CatholicSingles.com after they realized that they needed to find someone who shared their faith. Meet other faithful Catholics on the original Catholic dating site. Download our app today for free. Looking for a way to build daily prayer discipline? Seen the rise in mindfulness meditation, but not sure if it is possible to meditate in a way that's consistent with your Catholic faith? Just looking for a way to breathe new life into your existing prayer routine? No matter what you're looking for, Hollow is here to help. Hollow is a Catholic prayer and meditation app that helps users deepen their relationship with God through audio-guided contemplative prayer sessions. From meditations on the daily gospel, to the rosary, to daily examines, Hollow has something for everyone. Hollow is the number one Catholic app in the U.S. It is free to download and has permanently free content, but you can also check out all of the premium sessions for 30 days, risk-free, by signing up at www.hollow.app/breadbox.
Here we go. Hello and welcome to Beneath the Surface, where faith and reason meets, here at WCAP Radio 980. Glad you could join us tonight, for we are here every Monday night between 10 and 11 p.m., offering a little sanity into our age of insanity, a little life into our culture of death. Well, tonight, my fellow truth seekers, we go beneath the surface on the question of what is truth? Is truth objective, or is it purely subjective? How do we know? What does it mean? Well, heavy questions tonight. Get out your shovels, because we have a couple with us to delve beneath the surface with my first Monday evening of the month guest. There he is, your guest and mine, Mr. John Tudoris.
Hello, hello.
Mr. John Tudoris, what's it like being Mr. John Tudoris tonight?
Well, I'm alive, which is very important. I'm also here on the second Monday of the month.
You know, you have a good point there.
Yeah.
This is not the first Monday of the month.
Yes, it's an anomaly.
I wonder if anyone else thought of that when I said that, other than you.
I don't know. That's a good question.
Well, do you want to tell people why you weren't here the first Monday of the night, even though your voice was, by the way?
Yes, it is. Oh, really? You had a replay?
We had a replay last week.
Oh, what was the show?
It was, I think it was last month's, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Hey, second verse, same as the first.
Let's get Cindy on the line here. Miss Cindy, who is behind the glass, at least according to my perspective. Cindy, do you remember what you played last week?
I have no idea what I played last week.
Isn't that a big help, John?
Yeah, it's great help.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, Cindy.
Hey, well, you know, at least we're all on the same page.
That's right. Well, anyway, we're back here live this week. One of us was extremely under the weather last week, so we did play a replay. And, you know, if you didn't know any better, you'd think it was live.
Yeah, yes, yes. Yeah.
So you're on, actually, in a sense, 2 weeks in a row.
Was it Memorex?
No.
Does Memorex still exist as a company?
I do not know. That was back in the cassette days. Do you remember that? Is it Live or is it Memorex?
Yes.
And then you'd hear this in the commercial. You'd hear a lady singing a really high-pitched note and a glass breaking.
Yes. Or then when the guy would come by and then all of a sudden he was on the TV. And because their picture was supposed to be really clear.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. It's kind of like the Land O'Lakes lady. You just keep going and going and going.
That's not the Land O'Lakes lady.
No. She wasn't on Memorex, but she would have done well with Memorex.
All right. Anyway, whatever John is talking about, our phone number here is 978-454-4980. That's 978-454-4980. Now, if I'm not mistaken, John, one of your nicknames, I think it even precedes me knowing you, was Little John. Do you remember that?
Yes. I would sometimes use that as a moniker online.
Yeah. Little John.
Yes.
Yeah, and with the initials just LJ.
Yes. But then sometimes spelled EL space JAY.
Well, I got to admit that was my that was participation in the nickname.
Yes, and you've actually contributed to multiple nicknames.
I know. Ever since then, you've had about four or five. But but I was just wondering which one would you like to be referred to tonight?
I like them all.
You like them all?
Yes.
Okay. Which one?
Whichever one you're using at that moment is good.
I meant which mall. You said you like them all.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, so let us look at this question and see what we can yak about regarding it. That's why we're here.
Yeah.
What is truth? Now, it's an interesting question because one of the places it was first recorded as a question, actually, was the Gospel of John in the Bible, the New Testament of the Bible.
Yes.
Pontius Pilate, you know, this is very apropos if you're a Christian or even if you're not. This is Holy Week. We are living within Holy Week right now. And usually on Palm Sunday, which is yesterday, according to the Christian calendar, you hear the Passion story played out completely from one of the Gospels. And when it's the Gospel of John, which it didn't happen to be this year, but when it's in the Gospel of John, you hear Jesus say, "I came for one reason and one reason only," he says this to Pontius Pilate, "to testify to the truth." And Pilate simply says to him, "What is truth?" And then it's as if they both look at each other and the scene changes because Jesus doesn't give him an answer. But it seems to me, John, quite ironic that Pilate would ask that question to what Christians understand as he who is truth personified.
Yes.
You want to break that down a little bit before we get going?
Oh, wow. It's like we're skipping to the end on this one.
All right. Well, you want to hold that for later?
Yeah. This could be like the movie where they, like a Quentin Tarantino, they give you a little bit of the end in the beginning. And then they go back.
Let's do that.
Yeah.
Columbo does that too.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Oh, wait. Yeah. One more question.
Yeah. One more thing, sir. By the way, Columbo is a must-see for me and my wife every Sunday night.
Really?
Absolutely must-see, 8 to 10:30.
Wow.
Yeah, excuse me, 9:30. Yeah, MeTV, if you're interested. All right, let us Columbo this question, what is truth? So, where do you want to begin then?
Going to the way a lot of people think about truth now from the point of it being relative.
Okay, so then the question is truth objective or is it purely subjective? How do we know? What do you say?
I would say logically truth is objective by the very fact that even if someone claims that truth is subjective or relative, they have to use objective words with objective meaning in order to define it. Meaning that you cannot describe the belief of a subjective truth without objectivity.
Let me break that down a tiny bit because I know exactly what you're talking about. If somebody says to you, there is no objective truth, all you have to say to him back is that true?
Yeah.
Is that objectively true, what you just said? And how do they respond to that?
I suspect if I was reading one of your Facebook dialogues, that they would either fumble over their words or they would eventually cave in and say, yes, that is true. And then the response would be, well, why is it true?
Well, not just why is it true. If he says that it is true, then he's admitting that there is an objective truth.
Yes. Well, it's true for me.
Okay. Then it's subjective. If it's only true for you, why should I listen to you? Right?
Well, because it's and then you would proceed with more fumbling because no matter how much you try and dance around it, it...
Yeah, so any statement or any proposition it presumes that it is objectively true, or else why say it, right?
Exactly.
Why would somebody say there is no truth if they believe that there is? And so they're saying there is no truth, but by again, to repeat, just by making that statement, they presume that there is truth because the statement itself they believe is true. So it's an inner contradiction, isn't it?
Wow, my mind just hurt just listening to that right there. You know, I was thinking, though, on one reason why so many people are adhere to a relativistic or subjective view of truth is in part due to the promotion, or rather the teaching of children from an early age, and even a lot of our schooling systems, to give opinions without actually having a certain basis in truth, informing them well.
From the little I've heard over the past decade or so, that seems to be more and more prevalent, isn't it?
I have a right to be heard. Well, you have a right to speak, not necessarily a right to be listened to. I mean, you can't force people to listen to you.
I mean, even things as basic and elementary as mathematics, I have heard anyway through the grapevine that many approaches to it now in elementary and middle schools are never to say that something is wrong, but to say that how did you get there and why is that true to you?
Oh, wow. That's really terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I used to be a tutor at community college in math, actually, years ago, and we were encouraged to not be negative, which I understand has certain benefits, right, in so much as that particularly students who are maybe very discouraged, if it's not quite clicking, you want to focus on more of the positive. But at the same time, it was never to the point of a subjective truth. The goal was always to arrive at an objective conclusion within the mathematical equations and to help guide them along the way.
Now, those that there actually are radical skeptics today that believe that there really is no objective truth at all. And if there is, we couldn't know it anyway because we don't have the apparatus to know what is outside of ourselves in any real way.
Well, I would say they're wrong.
All right.
Well, I would say if in one way they, to a certain degree, you would say that they are right as far as the fullness of truth. I mean, we all have limited perspective, and so we can only know a certain degree of what something is.
Yes.
In fact, St. Paul, and I'll preface this by saying I'm. My aim in bringing up St. Paul is to look at this through the lens of reason, philosophy / science, rather than through a religious lens. But he talks about seeing the world through like rose-colored glasses, that we don't actually have a perfect perspective of the fullness of what truth really is. So in that sense, yes, I would agree with them.
So then, in other words, to absolutely, in its fullness, understand the essence of truth of everything, absolute truth is only God's purview. We don't get to have that. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's right. That's right. Only perfection can fully understand perfection.
Okay, so we can have a moral certitude, a partial certitude about things, or we can fully know that something happened this way or that way, or something is this color or that shape. But in terms of knowing it absolutely, that is a little above our pay grade.
That is very, very good. I like that term, above our pay grade.
Yeah.
Not that we're getting paid, but figuratively speaking, yes.
Hmm.
But now on the flip side to that, in your example there, if someone's saying we don't have any apparatus at all in order to perceive truth, well, that part would be going too far. So even though we cannot perceive the fullness of truth, we certainly can, to some degree, get to a degree of truth.
So when we say understand truth, we're talking about a correspondence of reality outside of us to become that which is in our mind. So in other words, to grasp it, to understand it as it is.
Yes.
That's what we mean by
yes.
knowing truth.
It's not what is outside of us corresponding to us, but rather that our mind corresponding, so to speak, rather apprehending what is objectively
there.
True,
yeah.
what is objectively there outside of us.
Do you think that these philosophers that actually have a skeptical or cynical understanding of truth really believe themselves? Can you get by day to day?
No, actually, you can't. Well, you remember that story, Bob LeBlanc, who is guest number two
yes.
on the rotating cycle? And he recounts this when he was at Ascension College, and one of the professors there did not believe in an objective reality.
Mm.
And in order to teach him a lesson, the dean of the department, and this is, of course, is before the days of direct deposit, we get his paycheck in an actual envelope,
yeah.
decided to teach him a lesson by giving him an empty envelope.
Mm.
Well, I guess he was not amused.
The professor
didn't believe in an objective reality. So he goes up to the dean. He says, "Where's my paycheck?" And he goes, "What paycheck?" And he goes, "Where's my paycheck?" And he goes, "What paycheck? That paycheck's not real."
Hmm.
Uh-huh.
All right. So then it's sort of something that academics play around with, but it's...
When the rubber hits the road,
it's not really possible.
They're full of store-high-end transit coming from a bull.
Let's look at... just really quickly in history, where this sort of began to turn. I mean, in philosophical history, there was something called the Kantian-Copernican Revolution in philosophy.
Yes.
Want to quickly just to the folks listening say what that is?
Actually, the term at least that I've seen in my recent studies. Oh, to be continued after the break.
Well, the reason why I asked is because this... Without understanding this particular event, this particular happening in philosophical history, none of what we're talking about tonight makes any sense. So, our phone number here at Beneath the Surface is 978-454-4980, 978-454-4980. I'm Paul Morano. You're listening to Beneath the Surface. My guest tonight, John Tudoris. We need to take a minute break. We will be right back. Don't go away. Welcome back. You're back, and we're back, and we're all back. John, you're front.
I am.
You are.
Fantastic.
All right, so you're listening to Beneath the Surface. This is WCAP Radio, and our topic tonight is on the question of what is truth. What is truth? Is it objective? Is it subjective? What is it? All right, so before the break, we were talking about this notion of where philosophies began to shift. Before modern times, we were always looking outside of ourselves, trying to understand being as being, and conforming ourselves to it. And that's one way that we could get along with the world and get along with nature. Then, first with Immanuel Kant and then René Descartes, this revolution of looking towards the self or the subject rather than the object and seeing that it is the subject that provides the truth or at least the truth framework for anything that we understand outside of ourselves, and therefore we really can't know anything outside of ourselves to be absolutely true.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll just back up a little bit on that. So before the characters of Descartes and Kant came onto the scene, there was a little precursor movement that actually helped bring that about.
I think I know what you're about to say.
Begins with an N.
Yeah. Nominalism. Go ahead.
Oh, that's 25 points for you.
I know. It is.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm sure some people have heard the term Occam's razor.
Mm.
William of Occam.
Really quick. What is it?
Yeah. The simplest explanation is probably the most likely one.
Yes. There you go.
Yes. But he was also somewhat infamous for helping popularize the notion of nominalism, which is that words do not convey an objective meaning. They only have meaning because I, the personal I, give it meaning.
Now, I want everyone to think about that for a second. That was huge. That was huge in terms of our understanding of the world and ourselves, that William Ockham, or our nominalism in general, was a movement that stated that we don't, when we name things, the nominalism comes from the word naming, our name. When we name things, according to nominalism, we are not discovering and then placing a word on that to understand its meaning, per se. We are actually giving it meaning. We are creating the meaning ourselves rather than passively understanding what it means. And so when we use language and we use terminology and labels, according to nominalism, we're creating truth rather than acknowledging it. And
yes.
that's a huge 180-degree shift.
It is, but it was more subtle at the time because
right.
It wasn't like William of Ockham was a full-on modernist. He wasn't quite at the point of what happened after Descartes, where the recognition of truth was much more of a subjective endeavor in the minds of many people. But it started with the words. The words are what ultimately lead to the meaning itself. And that movement had sort of it was like the snowball that ultimately helped the avalanche really start to kick into gear.
And if we could just move past some of those movements of the snowball to our day today, you can see how nominalism it has quite a progeny today.
Oh, yes. It's all around.
We create meanings rather than discover them with our language. I'll give you one example. Maybe you can give me your take on it. The word gender.
What's that? I mean, it means what I mean, I can be it. I can be,
right.
You know, whatever.
No,
I mean, who are you to tell me how I feel inside?
Yeah.
Because feelings, nothing more than feelings. Whoa, 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 feelings.
Okay, so I don't know if everybody understood that you were joking around, but...
Yes, I am.
tell me your... rather than your feelings, tell me your thoughts on the term gender and how nominalism might play some role in that.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, the term itself is meant to convey an objective reality in that the being of male or female is that all the way through. It's not just to convey, how someone looks, perhaps, or certain parts that they might have, or the clothes they might wear as a custom in their particular culture. It actually conveys who they are to the very core of their being, not just materially, but down to their soul.
Well, since Descartes' dualism really took root in people's minds, this notion that we can create a word called gender and have it mean something different than sex really took off. But is it even possible for that to be? Can that match reality?
Oh, objectively, no, not at all. The most it matches is someone's imagination, and an objective card that someone might be clicking off on a paper. You know, what do you perceive yourself to be? Male, female, other. It's like that joke from Fozzie Bear. Ah, my parents had three kids, one of each kind. Waka waka.
Well, a lot of people would say that the word gender is different from sex, in as much as sex is what you are biologically. Gender is what you want to appear to, or how to express yourself to the world or the culture. And you say what to that?
I would say that is tortured manufacturing of the real meaning of the word. It's jumping through hoops. Jumping through hoops to try and...
To try to create a meaning that really isn't there.
Yes, and even when someone tries to convey it that way, they're trying to do so in an objective manner. And they don't realize the whole logical contradiction which is going on.
So in other words, they're trying to say... They're making a claim that gender is an objective reality... But then when you ask what is your objective criteria for gender, they don't have an answer to that? Is that what you mean?
Not objectively, no. It's they're really appealing to a subjective basis for their objective claim.
Feelings, desires, that kind of thing.
Oh, yes.
All right.
Yes, what some of Plato and the ancients would term your passions and your appetites.
So then if some guy, for example, wants to wear a dress to express himself in that way in a society like ours, and I think most societies today, that would look feminine, right?
Not a kilt. Kilts are very masculine.
Except for kilts, yeah.
Particularly when they're like 6 foot four and they're tossing a caber. Very, very masculine. Don't insult them.
But my point is that you would say that there is an internal disordered desire or disordered attraction going on in the person from which they would need counseling that is preferable to creating the lie that they are a woman that happens to have a man's body.
Yeah, that's I mean, again, it's so contrary to reality. I mean that our I think our nature to a certain degree convulses away from it because our nature is actually geared towards objective truth.
Mm.
And it is only when our nature to some degree is dulled due to habits of vice that we don't notice as much. There's a term that is used sometimes, a dulled conscience, for example, which has a harder time recognizing what is objectively true and good, and may even see a vice as a good, even though their nature on the inside, to some degree or another, rejects it.
Would you say that this nominalistic notion of gender relates to a false understanding of the human person?
Oh, yes.
As being post-Cartesians would call dualism or dualist? Want to explain that a little bit?
Dualist? Now you're referring to...
body-person dualism.
Oh, you talk about how that goes back to really a Platonic idea.
Well, way back then, but Descartes in modern times sort of resurrected it.
That actually I haven't got into too much.
All right. Well, tell us what your understanding of dualism is.
That really we're ghosts in a shell.
Yeah.
That basically the matter is evil, and that the true perfection is actually this perfected form or spirit of the person.
Mm.
But the matter actually is not essential.
So then the person is the one or the invisible thing inside, the one that feels and thinks and so forth. Whereas the body is sort of just like a covering, like almost like clothing is, something that you can manipulate at will. And ultimate freedom, of course, is to cast off your clothing at death.
Yes, yes. Of course, with Plato, even though one could argue he was mistaken in that idea, and that Aristotle's notion that there actually is this perfect union, so to speak, of the body and soul together, that they're actually meant to be together. At the same time, it wasn't like Plato was aiming towards a subjective truth. He was still aiming at objective truth.
Right.
And that's an important distinction, whereas now this interior feeling that people have is really not geared towards objective truth.
It isn't, but it is geared towards an ontological or an anthropological dualism, in as much as the person, the real person of me, is the one inside. It's the invisible one.
Yes.
The body is something that I just have temporarily. It's something that I can manipulate at will.
Exactly. I can just go to get some surgery.
Yeah, it's not really me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's
so that false understanding of the human person, I think, plays well with this notion of, for example, of what we were talking about earlier of transgenderism. It's actually possible that one could be something different than their shell of a body.
Yes, and I would say that's the symptomatic, of course, of the greater disconnect between truth, the idea of truth being connected to objective reality.
Now, if truth is connected to objective reality, as you and I believe it is, then you would have to say that the person or the soul or the being inside is manifested perfectly in the body.
Yes.
Or the body is the personal manifestation of the soul, or the physical manifestation of the person. There can be no contradiction, of course, unless there is some genetic anomaly. But in those extremely rare cases, There is no contradiction between person and body.
No, there isn't. It's all one and the same. The term that's used sometimes in philosophy is the soul is the form of the body. And what that means is that the soul is actually the higher in principle than the body. The body, so to speak, takes its shape, its actuality from the soul. The soul is the first principle, but at the same time, they are still, because the human person is meant to actually be both. It's not like like a little larva that cracks through its shell to become the butterfly and leaves the shell behind. That's not what the human body is. It's actually meant to be one in union with the soul.
So if we begin with ourselves as being physically true, that the person is being manifested perfectly through his or her body, then we would extend that to the world, wouldn't we? That there is a certain objective truth in all of physical reality. And if we didn't begin with that premise, then the scientific method, for example, would have no meaning.
Oh, certainly. I mean, what we see in one likeness in us, we can see to a certain degree a likeness in other things as well. And that type of comparative reasoning goes down through the ancient times up to contemporary times now. For example, again, using it because a lot of people know about it, but you go in Scripture, and what does Jesus do to communicate certain higher truths?
Yeah.
Either truths that might be known through reason or that are given directly from God to man, is he uses simple analogies of things that are true in the material world, such as farming, agriculture,
right?
How people might do their business dealings. All of these things convey not just truths on a natural level here, but also something higher, because they reflect that. And this reflection of truth can be found in many things.
Very interesting. You mentioned two kinds of ways to mankind can attain truth. There's a third too. Let's look at all three. Because many people have rejected at least two of these three, and that is the senses.
Yes.
Understanding reality outside of ourselves through our five senses. And the question is, can we trust our senses? We mentioned Descartes earlier. He is one that basically went through a whole transformation, first going through the process of not trusting his very senses. We'll get into that later. Then there's the second part, which you mentioned, human reason.
Yes.
Being able to think and understand and figure things out. Logic, that kind of thing.
Oh, sure.
So you have understanding of truth through the senses, understanding our certitude through human reason, and then there's the third one that you mentioned, and that is divine revelation.
Yes.
Truth that perhaps that goes beyond the five senses, that may go beyond human reasoning abilities, that is given to us from above. And this is what religious faith, particularly the monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, are centered upon.
Oh, yes, indeed. And you know why that third one happens is so that we can become happy.
Yes.
And not in a fleeting moment of glee or euphoria, but rather for all eternity, actually. So true happiness, and this is a deeper understanding, has to do with things coming to a fulfillment of what they are supposed to be.
Right.
There's a full, I don't know if the word content is right, but it is a
fulfillment, full, flourishing.
Fruition, the whole nine yards. And so for human beings, that it actually comes not just in this natural world here, but we're actually designed for union with God, a relationship with God.
Now, these three ways of certitude that human beings have, which are the senses, human reason, and faith, are not and never meant to contradict each other.
That's right.
Even from a religious perspective, the religious person understands that God gave us five senses that actually work to convey for us to attain truth, and human reason for us to understand truth, and so that extra that God gives us comes in the form of faith in divine revelation is something that doesn't contradict the first two. That's That's the important part here. I want to stress with you.
Yes, indeed. The principle of non-contradiction, hugely important.
It's hugely important, and it's funny how those who are on the outside looking in, today's new atheists, tend to believe that if you have faith, that means that reason or the senses are being dulled or ignored or contradicted. And the religious person, at least, you know, from the Christian tradition, would say that is utterly absurd. All three have to be in congruent with each other, or else God is fooling the human person, and that doesn't make any sense.
That would be contrary to the nature of God.
Exactly. Well, we'll get into that a little more right after this break. You're listening to Beneath the Surface. Paul Morano here with my guest John Tudorus tonight. Cindy's behind the glass. Stick with us. We'll be right back. And we're back. 978-454-4980 is our phone number if you want to jump in. We're talking about the question, what is truth? The question that Pontius Pilate asked Jesus after Jesus said, I came for one reason alone, to testify to the truth. And Pilate, being the first moral relativist in recorded history, said three words, what is truth? All right, so we're talking all about that question. Is truth subjective? Is it objective? How do we know? And before the break, we were mentioning how there are actually three avenues to understanding truth or reality outside of ourselves. The five senses, which we share with the other animals. The gift of human reason, which we don't share with the other animals. You could say we share it with the angels. And divine revelation. So, senses, reason, and faith, each, you could say, reaches past the other. We can, you know, reason sees further than the senses, and faith sees further than reason. However, they, as we talked about right before the break, each one of these three needs to correspond with the other two. In other words, for example, belief or faith that has been proven to be unreasonable is called superstition. It's not real faith. Real faith has to be grounded in truth. And one way of understanding that is to bounce it off reason as well as the senses, because God does not contradict himself. All three ways for us to understand truth are gifts of God, one physical, one mental, and one spiritual. So that's what I was trying to get at, John. Those who are don't understand true religiosity would say that faith contradicts reason and the senses, and it's the exact opposite.
Yeah, I believe
it confirms
one of
them.
One of the terms I heard Bill Maher say was sky fairies. Just the make believe flying spaghetti monster, for example. This idea that God or belief in religious is for people who don't think, which is actually another thing that Bill Maher said in his Religious movie, Religious. And, of course, that's completely that's a caricature of what faith is. Yeah, if you're in some, and if they're listening, don't take offense, but, you know, some of the Protestant evangelical offshoots have an incorrect understanding of the fullness of what actually faith is. Faith is really a science. And think about, for example, if I'm an astronomer and I'm charting the stars, the heavenly bodies, the planets, I have to presume that gravity exists. Now, I don't know the full machinations of gravity on why gravity works the way it does. I have some theories. I have some hypotheses. Yeah, I might not have an understanding of Einstein's theory of relativity. I might have some mathematical understanding of how motion works in relation to gravity, but I don't know what makes gravity to its core. I have to take that on principle. Well, in the same way that the science of astronomy requires me to take that on faith, so too do the principles given in theology on the understanding of the nature of God. And so those we actually take on the authority of God himself, who by definition does not err.
Mm.
Truth does not contradict itself. Perfection cannot contradict perfection because that would be a logical error.
I see. You know, ironically, what seems to have happened in the past few hundred years is that, see, when a person who believes God exists and communicates to us, this same person has to believe that the gift of reason and the gift of the senses attain for us truth, because they believe in a God who created them. Does that make sense?
Rephrase that.
Well, if you believe in God, then you believe that God does not make mistakes when it comes to us, you know, how we are created and designed and how we can attain truth. In other words, our senses don't fool us. Our human minds can understand things.
The Christian God, yes.
Okay, that's what I'm getting at right now.
Right.
All right, so then the Christian God is logos because he is divine reason, as the Bible says. So he cannot contradict himself in creating five senses that didn't detect truth or a human reason that went awry if used properly.
Yes.
Right? All right, so then, in other words, what I'm trying to get here is trusting in God necessarily means trusting in our own minds, in our reasoning, and trusting in the five senses, as long as you're using them properly without bias.
Yes, I would very much agree with that.
Okay, this is what I'm trying to get at, that the new atheism, and I say new because it was around in ancient times, and it sort of began to rear its ugly head again in modern times. When you reject God, who is the glue to it all, then it makes sense. It's reasonable. It's logical to also begin to doubt whether you can know anything, whether your mind is telling you the truth, or whether your senses can actually detect any truth. So, in other words, if you lose trust in God, the Creator, it makes sense that you could very well lose trust in your own being.
That could be one symptom. The other symptom, which I've noticed, is an intellectual dishonesty. With the pursuit of truth. And by intellectual dishonesty, I don't necessarily mean that someone who is believing is objectively lying in the sense that, you know, a parent asks the kid, did you steal the cookie from the cookie jar? And they say no, when clearly they stole the cookie. It's more in the pursuit of truth where one may intuit or maybe objectively know that something is a more right path or a more right understanding, but may reject it or not follow it on purpose. There's a certain willful ignorance that happens, which causes them to not come to a fuller understanding of the truth.
Yeah, but why? It's out of fear.
There's fear. There can be other reasons too. Pride.
Fear, pride, right.
Quite frankly, money. Some of these new atheists make a business of it. Who is it? Not Richard Dawkins. No, actually, it was Dawkins. He tried to tackle Aquinas's five famous proofs by reason for the existence of God, and he misrepresented them.
Right.
Trying. So it's basically what they call a straw man argument, meaning that you take the actual argument or the thing it is that you are trying to
falsify it and then argue against it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, what I was getting at earlier is that Descartes, for example, let's get back to him. It was finally after he doubted that his five senses told him anything true, and he doubted that his mind was actually working. It was, and you mentioned this during the break, it was his thought of God as not being a God who fools us,
yes,
as not being an evil God. His understanding of a good God that brought him back literally to his senses, to trust his senses and to trust his reason.
Yeah, Descartes was a religious man, and even though he was known to be somewhat prideful, you know, for example, in his writings, it was his idea that mathematics was actually the greatest because it's the most certain of all the sciences, and of course he wasn't, and that you could basically prove out everything using it, and of course, unfortunately, that error is extended today because it misses out on what you mentioned earlier about being as being. There is actually a science to that, too. See, not all sciences actually have to do with things that we can know by matter, right? Actually, even think about it, mathematics, right? Mathematics is not by its nature material.
No, it's the mind.
It is.
That's why we said this a second one. That's the reason, human reason. Yeah.
But we can at least see it in matter. And right. So there's a certain connection there. But when it comes to the nature of being, you know, well, hold your horses there, you know, that it starts getting into a higher realm. But what a lot of people don't realize is that they already are entering into it naturally. It's part of our being. The two-year-old looks over and points as they're learning and says, look, doggy, kitty cat.
Yeah, we begin life presuming that our senses and that our mind work properly and can attain truth. We presume that.
Yes.
All children presume
and
that.
And on all levels, too.
Yes.
Naturally. Not just the lower levels of the sense knowledge or the mathematical knowledge. Oh, look, one doggy. Oh, two kitty cats.
And by the way, every child begins with a religious sense, too.
How so?
Well, Peter Kreeft goes through this whole thing about how all primitive peoples and all individual children, even in non-primitive places like the United States, we all begin with an openness to religiosity. We don't have to be convinced. We don't need arguments.
Yes,
it's all we need is the words, and we intuitively understand.
Well, that's because our nature is geared towards relationship. That's what religion really means at its root. Meaning is it's a relationship.
Well, it's relationship with that which goes beyond the senses.
Exactly.
And it's funny how human beings, even all the way from cave paintings, it's understood that the two things that are the two telltale signs that make some animals, you know, human and others non-human is the fact that we have a capacity, a natural capacity for language and religion.
Yes. Religion is actually considered a virtue.
Language enables us to understand and communicate abstract truths, abstract realities like ideas, thoughts, concepts. And religion, of course, enables us to grasp abstract or immaterial truths like God, angels, and so forth. So this ability that human beings have, and we see it in children, we see it in primitive tribes, we see it in everybody who has not, in a sense, been conditioned out of it by society, we see it as a natural capacity of the human person. And this is why we were talking about earlier, that our knowledge is the senses. We can trust the senses, but it goes beyond the senses to human reason, and it even goes beyond human reason to divine revelation.
Yes, and all so that we can be happy.
And that's all where it's pointing to, huh?
It is. A true fulfillment of our entire being, not just, again, a temporary euphoria or gleefulness or, oh, I got a smile on my face, I must be happy. That's fleeting.
Let me ask you this. Those who rationalize and have voluntary ignorance because they have a personal agenda and a bias and they want to continue a narrative, in other words, they're avoiding truth, they're denying it for some reason. Are you saying, John, that by doing this, they don't understand the true road to happiness?
Yes. I mean, none of us completely truly knows that, at least in our state now, because we're full of potential.
But the only way to happiness is through objective truth?
Oh, yes, in all levels. And not just truth as far as understanding and intellectual capacity, but also
embracing it.
Embracing it in our practice and our relationship with people, God, the whole world.
Assenting to it with our hearts and embracing it fully.
Our entire being.
And that, you say, even though there may be some sacrifice or suffering involved, that is the only way to true happiness and fulfillment.
Well, yes. And on that point of sacrifice and suffering, because some people may shy away, oh, I don't want to suffer, I don't want sacrifice.
And I think that's, by the way, that's the motivation behind all this denial and rationalization.
Oh, sure. But what they don't understand is that in every choice that we make, in everything that we do, we are inevitably sacrificing other things. In the business world, they have a term for it called opportunity cost. When you choose one thing, you inevitably do not choose the others. You sacrifice the others.
I'll give you another obvious example. When you get married, you just rejected 3 billion females.
At least.
That's what you just rejected.
Yes.
3.5 billion females.
Some of them, by the way, would be very hard to commute and go visit with.
That's true. But when you choose something, you go down a road in which you have rejected many other things. You've sacrificed other things. okay, I want to get to this important point that we began with. Pontius Pilate, looking at he who is truth personified, asks the question, what is truth? What do we mean, or what does Christianity in general, what do we mean by Christ is truth?
Well, because Christ is God. So all aspects that we see in the world that are true, and that could just be truth itself, could be goodness, beauty, being. Everything is a reflection of the ultimate perfection, which is found in that first cause of everything else.
So, in other words, everything reflects the Creator?
Yes.
And the truth and understanding of goodness and beauty of all things has its ultimate source and its ultimate in God Himself?
Yes, indeed. And just in the way that, you know, the artwork bears some degree the reflection of the artist, so too do we bear some degree of truth, goodness, beauty, all these things in relation to one who it came from. I mean, there's another principle of logic too, besides, and it's the principle of non-contradiction, that you cannot give what you don't have. So it has to come from a perfection of goodness if we were to have, if any of creation were to have it at all.
So whenever we say, whenever we speak of truth, we're speaking of something that is a reflection of the Creator Himself.
Yes, indeed.
And hence, when the Creator Himself comes down, takes on a human nature, and Pontius Pilate says, what is truth? He's actually looking at truth personified, isn't he?
Yes, he is, and he didn't even realize it.
There you go. Thank you, Mr. John Tudorus. Another good show. Always worth pondering with you. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Beneath the Surface. Glad you could join us tonight. We guess we'll see you next week with a different topic, different guest. For Christians, have a great Holy Week and a wonderful Easter on Sunday, and we will talk to you on Easter Monday.
Teachings for an Unbelievable World is a newly discovered work written by St. John Paul II, then Archbishop Karol Wojtyla of Krakow, in the years just after Vatican II. This is the first English language publication of this important work. In this hardcover book that Scott Hahn calls one of the greatest hidden treasures unearthed in our time, 13 brief homilies provide compelling teaching for Catholics in today's post-Christian world and give fresh insights into JP2's pontificate. You can get a copy of this important new book at AveMariaPress.com. Use code JP2Teachings, that's JPIIteachings, to get 20% off your copy today. Looking for exceptional coffee delivered fresh to your door? We have the answer. Our friends at Grim Bean Coffee produce small batch artisan coffee using top tier coffee beans. The coffee is roasted when you order, guaranteeing the freshest coffee possible. Check out Breadbox Roasts, a new line of Catholic themed coffees available at www.grimbeancoffee.com/breadboxmedia. Experience coffee like never before.